My name is Clinton Pettis, and I'm a member of the Baltimore Monthly Meeting of Stony Run. The plenary speaker for this evening is someone who has been involved in several organizations that are near and dear to many members of the Baltimore Yearly Meeting, and more broadly, to the Religious Society of Friends. These organizations include the American Friends Service Committee and the Ramallah Friends School in Palestine. More important, I think we can safely say that most of her professional life, if we include Oxfam of Great Britain, has been devoted to service with organizations whose missions have been to help others overcome interrelated forms of injustices, including economic, social, and education. As we reflect on the theme for this annual session, radical listening rooted in love, I'm certain that there have been numerous times when our speaker has had to face challenges that seemed insurmountable and had to stand still in the light, open herself and listen deeply and unflinchingly with love to others, to accept her own humanity and to see the other in herself. As a result of her journey as a Palestinian American, as a third generation friend, and a member of the Ramallah Monthly Meeting, she says to us, "Trust in the voices of the oppressed. Transformation is possible with listening and trusting." As a former member of the American Friends Service Committee, I consider this a deep honor and a special privilege to present someone to whom I hope that each of us will share a period of radical listening. Now, if you will join me in a moment of silence, I'm pleased to ask our plenary speaker and General Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee, George Osloony, to rise when she is led and bring us the message for the evening.
Good evening. It is lovely to be with you again. I was at BYM before, at Frostburg, twice, I believe. And so it's lovely to see familiar faces, and I look forward to having an engagement after this talk to get to know you a little better and hopefully answer some of your questions. I was told it's a 45-minute talk, so it may be a little long, so bear with me, but it is true that I'm not yet done with my first year with AFSC. September 1st is when I started, And I met an old friend, Jean Wilson, and I was just telling her how working with AFSC feels very much like working for the Ramallah Friends School, not just because of they're both Quaker organizations, but they all have histories and people where lives were touched and moved. And I believe that's really what drives me and so many others to work for organizations like the Ramallah Friends School and AFSCs, because we really encounter so many people, graduates, alums, former volunteers, former staff, who tell us that these organizations changed their lives. And so what a beautiful place to be in service with the American Friends Service Committee. So thank you for giving me this chance to talk to you today. And I want to start with something that happened. It's kind of changed my talk around because it happened 3 days ago. And it's a personal story. And I want to start with that because it says a lot about the importance of listening to the other. 3 days ago, my son, who's 26, still finding himself, called me from Ramallah with an urgency to talk to me about his trip. He made a trip to Yad Vashem. Yad Vashem is the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, as you all know. I was pleased yet surprised that he made the decision to go. I was wondering what made him do that, and what were his takeaways from the visit? I was so looking forward to hear. As he processed this dramatic experience with me on the phone, he said, "We're not hearing them, Mom, and they're not hearing us." When I asked him if the visit changed him and how, he confirmed that it did have a transformative impact on him. He explained how moved he was and how distraught to be starkly reminded of the pain and suffering of an entire population. He added that he couldn't help but draw parallels with Israeli policies imposed on Palestinians today. Same tactics of ethnic cleansing, segregation, deportation, dehumanization, and subjugation. He spoke of how the Jewish nation state law, if you're following the news, recently passed by the Israeli Knesset, deeming the right of self-determination exclusive to the Jewish inhabitants, establishing that Hebrew is the national language of the State of Israel, and downgrading Arabic, and finally stating that the Jewish settlements, and hence the illegal confiscation of land, are a national value. All of that is a clear example of the parallels with the anti-Semitic Nazi legislation and the Nuremberg race law imposed in pre-war Germany. My son went on and on with detail enough to form the foundation of an excellent academic thesis. But this is not the subject of my address here today. More importantly, he passionately expressed the need to start a campaign to introduce Jewish and Holocaust studies in all Palestinian schools. Those millennials don't cease to amaze us with their bold ideas, don't they? He said, "My narrative is incomplete without understanding the narrative of my oppressor." Finally, he did affirm that investing time in listening and learning about the other set of truth out there does not take away in any way or form from the oppression and suffering of my people, he said, and the need to continue resisting nonviolently. I say I raised a real Quaker child, don't you think? In Palestine, people dismiss the importance of learning about Jewish history and in studying about the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe of 1948. The studies of the Nakba is banned from schools, and students are taught that the Israeli state was created on a land without a people for a people without a land. dismissing the massacres and the exodus of the Palestinian people and their decade-long dispossession. Two separate narratives, two separate histories that don't ever converge. One is of persecution, the other of dispossession. For me, it was only after I had various engagements with Israeli individuals, civilians, not the soldiers I encountered in the streets, that I started seeing the humanity of the other. One of my first encounters was with an Israeli mother. Her daughter and my son shared the same medical syndrome. It's called Williams syndrome. She was an artist in Tel Aviv, and she provided information for me. There was no internet at that time, and I had nowhere to go except her, and comfort, and became, and still is, my friend, Michal. I started seeing my oppressors as humans, not only soldiers. I saw them as people entrenched in a culture of fear and stories of the past to the extent that they are blinded about the atrocities their government commits in their name. Seeing the human face of the other does not take away from the need to resist the structures of oppression through nonviolent means. And on the flip side, even if our courageous leaders emerge by some miracle and a just and lasting peace becomes a reality, the peace of the hearts and minds will not materialize, truly materialize, without the trust, empathy, and the appealing to the moral conscience of the other. It will not materialize without the act of, as I was reminded by Mark Nepo in the BYM theme brief, it will not happen without the act of leaning softly to examine the other with a willingness to change. I would like to take this argument to a different context, which recently came to my attention. Henry Cadbury, one of the founders of AFSC, thought that opening our hearts to the other truths is sufficient to dismantle systems of oppression. He said so. He did so when he asked the Jewish people in 1934 to educate Nazis about Judaism's ideals and, quote, appeal to the German sense of justice and the German national conscience. That's quoting Henry Cadbury. He asked them to do that instead of adopting nonviolent resistance campaigns such as boycotts, which, according to him, were not the way to right the wrongs being inflicted on the Jewish people. This is where I disagree with Cadbury. I think there is always room for both. If Cadbury had asked the Jewish people at the time, they would have not supported his position. Hence, again, the importance of trust and deep listening to those impacted. For those oppressed and with their existence threatened, resistance becomes a matter of survival. Such resistance efforts have to always be coupled by an appeal to the moral conscience of human beings. I believe that people are inherently good, and as Quakers, the notion of that of God in everyone makes it important for us to stay the course. But this should not, by any means, replace nonviolent resistance effort, as Cadbury suggests. In responding to the query, what does it require to come with open heart and mind, prepared to discover and follow where spirit is leading me, British Yearly Meeting's Quaker Faith and Practice reminds us, quote, open minds are not empty minds, nor uncritically receptive. The service of the meeting calls for knowledge of facts, often painstakingly acquired, and the ability to estimate their relevance and importance. Having served in leadership with AFSC for the past 11 months, I have witnessed numerous examples of how programs succeed because of the deep listening to and the trust in the voice of the impacted communities where we work. I've also seen it play out in our internal structures and in how organizational decisions are made. And I sometimes feel I'm a fly on the wall. I tell them I'm still in my honeymoon. I could just say I'm still, you know, examining the lay of the land, and I'm still listening and absorbing. And so I know my honeymoon will be over soon. So, but I could still make that assumption to say, as an outsider looking in, this is what I saw, this is what I witnessed, because AFSC was never part of my life before. So, and today I feel I want to share with you some of that, some of sort of what did I learn about AFSC in 11 months? Not necessarily about what we do, where, but sort of our strengths, our approach, and basically where I see that added value is. So I have seen that deep listening play out in our internal structures as well, and in how our organization makes decisions. An obvious example is our commitment to deep listening is how we designed our year-long and ongoing strategic planning process. New leadership comes in, and what does she do? 10-year strategic planning process, and it's been awesome. As we move into our second century of history, and as the fabric of domestic and global society is shifting in profound ways, we saw that it's important for us to take stock and re-envision our contribution to the change we seek in the world. We are therefore launching a bold and spirit-led strategic revisioning process. Rooted in Quaker principles, the new plan will re-examine and recommit us to inspired strategies for the next decade. And to quote from our statement of purpose for the strategic plan, AFSC's history is rich with achievement. We also experience difficult times. A deep and reflective discernment will serve as a precious opportunity to nurture a cohesive and inclusive AFSC family. In looking boldly inward, outward, and forward through an inclusive and transparent process of consultation, we will be drawing on the wisdom of staff, volunteers, members of the Friends community, and constituents, including the communities with whom we partner. We will listen respectively to diverse perspectives and remain open to new ways of bearing witness as an effective partner that strives for peace with justice in a constantly emerging world. So this is how an example, we said this is a 12-month process because we felt if we wanted to be true about the listening part of it, listening to communities, listening to partners and staff and volunteers, and the Quaker community at large, we really needed to give it a lot of time. And so that's sort of where that commitment comes from. Externally, I have also witnessed our work done quietly with humility, yet provocatively with courage. I have seen the service committee's strength in its approach of peace building and social justice. I have seen it in our convening power and quiet diplomacy, our deep-rooted relationships that we have established with communities through accompaniment and mutual learning. I've seen it in the trust and credibility we enjoy with our partners and allies, in our efforts to amplify the voice of the impacted, especially on Capitol Hill, the resources and technical capacities in activism that we help build. So in our convening power and quiet diplomacy, the head of one of the international peace-building organizations, when I asked him about sort of where he sees our added value, he said sort of a term that stuck in my head. He said, we're offering strategic humility. I'm like, okay, what does that even mean? But made me think about being strategic, but also being humble about the work. And I've seen that across all our programs in the U.S. and globally. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But the convening power is something that I felt was very, very powerful too. The quiet diplomacy that we do, things that, you know, you don't read a lot about in our information or on our website. It's really quiet, but as the General Secretary, I've been discovering a lot of that. It's like being the president and discovering all of these, you know, interesting secrets of the organization. So in Myanmar, I was there last fall, and I saw how our partner, our staff worked very diligently in selecting partners that were very courageous in how they wanted to proceed with the peace building in their country. As you know, the Rohingyas and the Buddhists are neck to neck, and then the Rohingyas have now fled across the border. And most organizations, you know, who offer humanitarian aid are in Bangladesh, in the refugee camps, offering relief and assistance there. Well, our partners, they said, there's enough going on in the camps. I think we have a different role to play. So we have supported them to quietly bring together Rohingyas, Buddhists, and other members of the Muslim community. They come together and they talk about how they want to provide relief to those suffering. And we support them with that. So they are providing relief to the Rohingyas who remain in their state and that have not fled to Bangladesh. So very little attention, they said, is giving to those who have not fled, who remain there in Myanmar. And so we're supporting a group that brings together everybody to provide humanitarian assistance to the Rohingyas. And I remember going to meetings and going through alleys, and we weren't supposed to be seen as meeting with certain people. So it's a really very quiet, sensitive work. Yet we do it. And I think that's something that I've heard over and over again wherever I go, that AFSC is doing work that no one else dares to do. And so to me, that was, you know, something else that I took with me, as this is very courageous work. In terms of our deep-rooted relationships that we have established with communities through accompaniment and mutual learning, that came to me very strongly when I go and meet with some of our donors and our supporters, and I ask them, why do you give AFSC? And I had expected that they're going to come back and say, well, because we like your work on mass incarceration or immigration, or we like your work in Palestine. Well, I heard none of that. And the majority of them said, it's because your long-term accompaniment with communities and your approach and your respect to the communities and how you work with communities. And so to me, that was sort of a learning moment. The other strength is the trust and credibility we enjoy among our partners and allies. I want to give an example of our work in Zimbabwe, where I was a couple of months ago. We've been in Zimbabwe for about 10 years, and we're working with members of a community that are in conflict because they don't agree politically. They weren't living next to each other, but their government uprooted them from their dwellings and moved them to an area and forced them to live together. Well, you know, peace-building organizations come and start, you know, conflict resolution programs. Well, that doesn't work because people don't trust you immediately. So we went into the community 10 years ago and said to them, so what are your needs? And they said, well, we need to eat. You know, we need livelihood. And so we're like, okay, so forget the peace building. Let's work on livelihood. And we supported them in building a factory shell where They train on vocational training, men, women alike, and then we provide them space to also sell their products or their services or their expertise, whether it's welding or carpentry or hairdressing or whatever it is we supported them with. Now, after a few years, we built that relationship with them. And after that, that livelihood work became a very good entry point for us to start the peace-building work. And so that's sort of the long-term effect of our accompaniment. A lot of the development organizations, international development organizations that I'm aware of and I know of, they do what I call hit-and-run type of projects. They've got money, they've got to spend it, they go to a country, they do some capacity building, training, they build a building, and then they're off to go to another country. And so, and that really is not how we do business in our development program. And so the long term and the trust we enjoy from our partners and our allies has been something that really also spoke to me. Our efforts to amplify the voice of the impacted, especially on Capitol Hill, this is sort of one thing that, you know, because we have our office for public policy in Washington, D.C., we also feel that one of our objectives for AFSC is to change public policy and to change public opinion and all of that. And so we have been working very diligently on several projects. I want to highlight one that was a huge success, must have been about, 6 months ago. We helped introduce or convince one of the representatives, Betty McCollum, to introduce a bill. It's called Promoting Human Rights by Ending Israeli Military Detention of Palestinian Children Act. She introduced it and through it required the Secretary of State to certify that the United States funds do not support military detention, interrogation, abuse, or ill treatment of Palestinian children. Of course, it's not going to be passed, but it started the dialogue around this issue. And for the first time in history, a bill that spoke to the rights of Palestinians was introduced on the Hill. And that is because of our strong relationship with our Palestinian partners on the ground who amplified this issue, and their voice about it basically culminated in this. The resources and technical capacities and activism that we help build is something I see everywhere, whether it's in Concord, New Hampshire, in our office there that basically became the address for activism. Any community member in Concord who wanted to be active on anything would go knock on Arnie's door, and Arnie would help empower them and give them the resources and the tools to be active and succeed. Our Sanctuary Everywhere work, our Communities Against Islamophobia work, and more recently, if you've been following, we started a new campaign with our allies. We called it Abolish ICE. And these are very provocative, bold, challenging work that challenge structural racism and xenophobia and religious intolerance. And with partners and allies and community partners, AFSC has played a role and as a thought partner, a toolkit provider and generator, a facilitator, a funder, and an encourager and moral supporter of people who wanted to be active on their issues. So these are sort of the strengths I found in our approach. But I want to also take advantage of the time to highlight some more examples of these approaches that I personally witnessed through my travel. I told you about how partners tell me that we support things that no one there touches. And to me, I found that all over the map, really. In Indonesia, for example, this fall, I saw how our program brought together religious leaders from various denominations, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, all sorts, otherwise having no other opportunity to sit around the same table. I witnessed a meeting there where they were all sharing and discussing joint programming together. They did art murals of art and in their neighborhoods to encourage religious tolerance, but also they advocated for change in oppressive policies and legislations in their country. Our belief in the value of each person and that everyone can be a peace builder also led us to work in North Korea, where we have engaged both humanitarian work and people-to-people diplomacy. AFSC worked on the Korean Peninsula since 1953. When we arrived to help the reconstruction of refugee aid projects, we have been working in and with North Korea since 1980, helping facilitate people-to-people exchanges. We were the first U.S. public affairs organization to send a delegation to Pyongyang. Since 1996, we have worked on food security and have had a great deal of success by partnering with Korean farmers to improve agriculture in the north. AFSC contributed to the introduction of rice trays and greenhouses, which has had an impact on the livelihoods of farming communities. Again, another example of how long-term engagement and accompaniment with this time a farming community in North Korea gained us their trust. Key to AFSC success is working in close partnership with North Korean counterparts. Relationships that have developed between AFSC staff and local farm managers, agriculture scientists, and government officials have over time facilitated a degree of trust and openness in discussions around shared goals and have afforded continuity in activities year to year. More effective than short-term humanitarian aid, long-term assistance projects that address real human needs in a pragmatic and respectful way have the potential to produce tangible results in the DPRK by building trust, supporting change, and benefiting ordinary Koreans. We have demonstrated, like many like-minded international NGOs, that engagement with the so-called, quote, enemy does work. Our DPRK partners expressed optimism about the recent improvements in relations between their country and the U.S. and South Korea. They expected the result of the recent UK DPRK summit to be good. They were so optimistic. Things will improve for them, they thought. They will have a chance for economic development and a better life. In San Diego, Des Moines, Denver, Greensboro, Fresno, and many other countries around this nation, our work is very successful because it is informed by the impacted. These cities I mentioned have programs that work with immigrants. We work directly with undocumented immigrants to ensure their needs are being addressed. Some of them are our staff. Our project, 67 Sueños, brings underprivileged migrant youth together and empowers them to make changes in their lives. The program creates safe spaces where young people can engage in healing circles and foster deep relationships with peers, adults, and community leaders. Youth learn organizing and advocacy skills, lead campaigns, participate and coordinate community actions, host public events, and engage in an intensive mural creation process derived from the real experiences of the community surrounding them. This is their project. We don't tell them how to do it. They are the ones, the migrant youth come in and say, this is what we want to do. Their efforts are designed to create local and national immigration policies that go beyond legal this and illegal that, and humanize the victims of a broken immigration system. in Tucson, in Baltimore, in New York, in Newark, in Oakland, in Michigan, and many other cities around the country. Our work on mass incarceration, something I know this yearly meeting is very keen on, prison reform, is done with the impacted on the in the center. I have been so taken to visit these offices and see formerly incarcerated people, now our staff, working with us to design the work, to design what we should do, how we should do it. Again, it is beyond listening to them. It is engaging them, trusting them, and doing with them. And so this is the one example that really brings a smile on my face every time I think of Larry White, because he has a beautiful smile. Larry White, in our Newark office, was incarcerated for a very long time, over 25 years. While there, he felt that those with long prison sentences have no way to cope with their long sentences. They just go day in and day out, and there's no one to advise them, mentor them, provide them any type of support of how to deal with a long sentence or a life sentence. So he started engaging with them while incarcerated, and he started talking to them about methods of coping. So when he left prison, somehow he landed in our office. And so today, Larry White is the author of our curriculum, Hope Lives for Lifers. And this curriculum, we have worked with the correctional facility and convinced them that it, in New York, and we have convinced them that this is a curriculum worth sharing. And Larry White and another facilitator go to that same prison where he was, and they deliver that curriculum to the lifers or those with long sentences. So that's the listening, and that's the trusting in the community, and what beautiful work it really brings about. Something about our quiet work is a meeting I attended in Zimbabwe. We call it the DEP. It stands for Dialogue and Exchange Program. We have a lot of those. They're sort of South, Global South to Global South exchanges, where we bring people together so they can talk about their experiences. The meeting I attended was brought together members from the religious leadership with members of the Peace and Reconciliation Commission, not only in Zimbabwe, but in South Africa, from Burundi, from Kenya, from Togo. So we invited, through our partners, all of these members from Peace and Reconciliation in Zimbabwe to talk to the Zimbabweans and the religious leaders about their experience with peace and reconciliation, what works, what doesn't work, and to share their experiences. Well, that's a very interesting sort of, in itself, it's an interesting topic. But to me, what grabbed my attention was that I know it is us who funded it, who organized it, who thought of it, but like, where was AFSC? I mean, our staff were sitting sort of in the corner somewhere. Our logo was like in the middle corner. You could barely see it on the screen. And we were sort of almost invisible. And our partners are the ones who took the lead, who brought in the keynote speakers and organized the whole thing. And to me, that was sort of another example of that humility, that humble, quiet work that we do. Although I'm not sounding too humble myself, right? I told AFSC staff after a few months in service, I said, I have a new title. It's called CEO, but CBO, Chief Boasting Officer. So I said, I'm going to be your boasting officer, because there's so much wonderful work. And so, again, in Palestine and Israel, back to the work there, we take the lead of our carefully selected partners and support their objectives. So we listen to where their interests are. And in Palestine, our program's main priority is to contribute toward confronting fragmentation caused by Israeli occupation, challenging militarized society, supporting active nonviolence and social change movements, and facilitating increased cohesion across Palestinian communities in different locations. In Israel, our programs focus on challenging the militarization of Israeli society. Just 3 weeks ago, I was in Tel Aviv, and I met one of the members of an organization that we support. She's a 20-year-old woman, Tamar, and Tamar is a refuser. She refused to enlist in the Israeli army, and she spoke to me, and I remember tearing up pretty badly listening to her. Yes, as a Palestinian, to see how someone's commitment to anti-war, anti-occupation, took her from one prison to the next, day in and day out. For 4 months, she was in and out of prison 4 times. And, you know, I couldn't but help think of my 22-year-old son in parallel and just be in awe at her courage. And so we support an organization that it's not even registered, believe it or not. And so, you know, organizations only, normally development, international development organizations will not hear of supporting a group of young women and men who are not registered and officially, you know. So, but we found a way to support this group. And it's a support group. You know, there's a parent group associated with them as well. And Tamar told me, if it weren't for this group, you know, she would have been so lost in her struggle. And so, again, moving on and their leading, seeing where they want to go and supporting them rather than telling them where and what they should do. And as you can imagine, these sensitive topics, whether around refusing service in the military, are another example where our partners appreciate that we are trusting them and standing by them to help them resist oppression and attain freedom. As a result of our work and our support to the BDS movement, for example, Israel banned AFSC from entering Israel. I'm sure you've heard about that. If not, I'm telling you. And we were one of the 6 U.S. organizations banned from entering Israel. You know, we talked a lot about this at our head office in Philly, and we said, you know what, this is a badge of honor. It's a testament that our work is provocative, and it's indeed making a difference. And so so far, if you're wondering, none of our staff have been banned entry, and a lot of people were wondering about me because I'm a Palestinian. My mom lives in Palestine. My husband lives partly in Palestine. So I go there often. And so they were worried that I won't be allowed in. But because I have a Palestinian residency, I sort of have more clout. No one can, although they can, do anything they want, really. But the likelihood of them deporting me is unlikely. So we hold in the light all of our other staff who will continue to go and in the hope that we will not be banned. But this is the result of courageous work. So I spoke a lot, and I want to end by sharing with you how my conversation ended with my son on the phone 3 days ago. He shared that he wants to gather like-minded people and start a campaign, right, calling for Palestinian students to start learning about the history of Jewish people in schools and universities. Knowing that it is a challenging endeavor, I encouraged him. I encouraged him because I was really inspired by the work I've seen at AFSC. I've seen how challenging work can really produce results. After all, it is the provocative work that is rooted in listening, knowing, trusting, and acting that has historically changed lives. So let's continue to do the provocative work, the work of God. Thank you, and have a wonderful Spirit-led annual gathering. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joyce, for being such a wonderful CBO of the AFSC. Thank you, friends. Joyce has agreed to respond to questions, if any of you are led to raise a question. I think she would also be okay if any of you wish to comment. So with that, we'll let Joyce come back before us. She said for this part, she wants to move around. So she's connecting technology. Not getting a green light?
No. Hello? Sorry? You without this? Oh, with it. Oh, okay.
It's
okay. Well. It is a red light. I was told it should be green. Okay. All right. Yeah. So I'll be happy to take questions or comments. If any. Oh, you too, huh? I hear you well.
Okay. With all these years of work in many parts of the world, does AFSC find that their work is eliciting interest from people about the Quaker faith?
You know, I think interest is one thing. I think interest is there. Everywhere I go, people are asking me, who are the Quakers? What are Quakers? Does it go beyond interest and just figuring out? No, probably not. But interest, absolutely. In Palestine and Israel, I was surprised. No one knows us as AFSC. They know us as the Quakers. So it's quite dangerous, huh? They're all speaking in your name. We're working, no, but it's funny because people say the Quakers, and I think because the schools were there in Palestine, you know, and through the parents and the students, you know, people already know what Quakerism is about. But I've seen it, actually, come to think of it, Dialogue and Exchange Program I spoke of in Zimbabwe. I know that Natabi Singh, who is our country director there, she said a few words of introductions, and she took the opportunity to sort of say what AFSC is and who are the Quakers, etc. So we try to sort of use that as an opportunity always to talk a little bit more about our values and what makes us who we are. See the young ones up there. Yeah.
As a young person, what can I do to be involved with American Friends Thank Service
you.
Committee?
Thank you. I've got a page on that. No, seriously, I did prepare something, but I could tell it to you without reading it. But we are so fortunate to have a director for Friends Relations. Her name is Lucy Duncan. Some of you may have already encountered her in your meetings and churches. And Lucy developed a page on our website. So if you go to www.afsc.org/friendsengage, okay, Friends Engage, and there you will see a page that lists all sorts of things that you can do to engage, whether you're an individual or a meeting or a church. You can find all sorts of different ways. She lists 11 ways of engaging, and some of them are very simple. Some of them are more organizational, like our Quaker Social Change Ministry. I don't know if any one of you have heard this, but we have a Quaker Social Change Ministry, which is a program that connects our spirit-led sort of Quakerism and our worship with activism, and it connects them really nicely. And it connects them to the work of AFSC by creating groups which focus on AFSC's key areas of work, whether it's immigration work or it's mass incarceration work or it's economic justice work. You form a group. And so that group has the benefit of enjoying many resources from Lucy herself, but also a lot of webinars and things online that will walk you through what you could do together. There's, you could do it creatively through storytelling, group reflections, and centering worship. And so there's a lot on that website, and I urge you all to go and explore the Friends Engage website on through our homepage and take this on. All right?
Are there ways that AFSC could work in Friends schools to involve students in the projects of AFSC?
You speak my mind. Coming from, as a former educator, that's where I feel the change should happen. I have been talking to Lucy about that, but Lucy's department is one person herself. And so she's charged with Friends relations across the board. Yes, it should include schools and universities, but she is on her own. But still, I want to challenge that, and I want to see what we can do, even if it's a pilot project in one or two schools or in one or two universities, that we can pilot and see. Because to me, this is where the change needs to happen. And that one question we just received from a young person up there is a testament to sort of these young people want to do something, or they want to be active, and this is the way to get them to do it. In the olden days, as you know, there was the volunteer camps for AFSC, and that's what sort of drew people into the AFSC world. And so we need to sort of look for an alternative. And hopefully through our strategic plan, that the planning that's taking place, we can better articulate how do we bring in the young people from the schools and colleges. Thank you.
Can you give us some insight into how you decide what to do?
No.
So there's problems everywhere, and I mean everywhere. And I don't just mean outside the United States, I mean inside the United States. And there's poverty, and there's violence, and there's discrimination, and there's immigration issues. There's how women are treated, there's how children are treated,
there's
and on and on and on and on and on. So there's way more than you can handle. Okay. But you've got to make choices. How do you do that?
All right. Very good question. When I was preparing for my interviews with AFSC, I was reading their annual reports and all sorts of things, and I'm like, what in the world does this organization do? It does everything. I mean, there's a little bit of here, a little bit of there. And I felt like this is great work, but it was all over the place. And after I joined AFSC, I understood why. It's because AFSC is so rooted in the communities where we work that it really depends on what the community feels are its priorities. And so if this community says, we want to work on economic rights, and we say, oh, okay, we'll help you there. If this committee comes and says, we want to work on immigration, oh, we'll help you there. So that model does produce a sort of fragmented AFSC. And what this strategic planning process is doing is to sort of, it's using appreciative inquiry, which says, let's build on what works and what we do well rather than solve all the world's problems. So let's see where our strengths are and let's build on them. And to better enable us to do that. But one other thing that also impressed me about AFSC is how decisions are made. We have executive committees. We have, in the United States, we have four regions, right? And in internationally, we have one region, all the international work. So we have five executive committees in AFSC. These are members of the community, members of the Quaker faith, members of, basically the community and members of the Quaker faith. That's who they are. So they come together and they make the choice of what programs to fund and what programs not to fund. So program choice is not with the general secretary. I can't come as a general secretary and say, we need to fund this work. I don't have that authority. So, which also says something beautiful about decision-making and power in the organization, that decision-making at that level is with these committees. Now, having said that, it's not sort of, we do have, and you'll see them on our website, five key areas. And we do ask and the board does say we've got priorities, and, you know, economic activism, the immigration work, the racism, anti-racism and inclusion work, the mass incarceration work. And so we ask our executive committees to build programs that align with these key areas. So still, our new strategic plan will help, it's going to help focus us a little bit more. But that's sort of how the decisions are made. Does that answer your question? It's a start. I'm still figuring it out. Yep. Adrian.
Thank you. In some ways, this question builds on Pierce's. Oscar Mbali and I are now working at the Belize Friends Center in Belize City, Belize. We're in South Belize City, which is all pretty dreadful place. Not many people would really choose to live there. It's overrun with drug trafficking. Apparently, the U.S. Navy was successful in diverting the flow of drugs into the United States by sea, so it's now coming by land. It comes across Central America from Colombia, comes through Belize to Mexico and up to the United States. The other compounding factor is the gang activity in Central America that was largely started by the U.S. deporting gang members, particularly from Los Angeles, but from other places. And so now they're kind of running amok in Central America. I wonder if there's a role that AFSC might consider in the region. Friends in South Belize City have started some programs, but they're obviously limited in scope because this is a regional problem. It's not just Belize. Mm-hmm. I think you've given me some answers in your response to Pierce, but how would a little Quaker community such as Belize City advance ideas for a program initiative by AFSC?
Great question. And I, the one region I have not visited yet is Central and Latin America. And I, one thing that we have found to be very challenging is how to start work in a new area that we haven't been in. You know, also one thing I did not mention is that we have been going through a financial crunch at AFSC. And in 2007, before I joined, you know, we had to lay off some staff, and it wasn't, it was very painful. And so I came into an organization that was ailing, and so I'm hoping that this strategic plan is going to lift us up a little bit. But because of limited resources, it's very hard for us to start new programs in a new area where we have no expertise or no staff, no presence, no trust in the community. If we want to do work in Belize, it means we have to give up work somewhere else, pretty much, unless we succeed in, you know, raising restricted funds for that work. And so we, for example, debated endlessly whether or not we should do work in Puerto Rico after the disaster there. And we thought that, no, because we don't have a program there to deploy staff. We don't have, we're not, you know, your CARE International or Oxfam GB where they have, you know, staff and resources set aside for these things, or they send and deploy humanitarian aid workers and start working there. We're not that type of organization, so it's difficult. But, you know, having said that, I think one thing the strategic plan is going to help us answer is not the work on the ground, but in terms of policy and advocacy, do we have a role to play? Like in Puerto Rico, we did, with our office in D.C., we did put out policy positions on Puerto Rico and, you know, the need for additional aid and et cetera from the U.S. to Puerto Rico. And so we made a statement on the policy part. And so we engaged at that level rather than on providing the, you know, the assistance on the ground. So, you know, unfortunately, right now, it would be very difficult to start a new program in a place like Belize. However, having said that, I don't think it's a shut door altogether. I think if there is a community there that is excited about a particular line of work that sort of aligns with sort of our priorities as well, I think it makes, to me, it makes a very exciting opportunity that we can find synergies and work together with the local Quaker community in Belize or any other area to do something good together. When I was in Kenya a few months ago, I met with the Quaker community in Kenya and I said, you know, what are you doing? Well, this is what we're doing. Well, how can we work together? And I think, and in Kenya, for example, we are supporting the work of Kenyan Quakers there. We do that very consciously and intentionally because we feel that if there are Quaker communities and we are there, then it is a natural sort of synergy that we need to come together.
Hi, my question for you is so much a sequel to the ones that we're, you've just been dealing with. I hesitate a little to ask it. This must have been an unusually interesting conference, just a priori, to give a talk to because we're here to listen. And so here, you know, we listened to you, and what I kept hearing you say was the word partner. And I wanted to invite you to tell us how the carefully selected partners, and this just follows right on from what you were talking about, how does the AFSC, I mean, the way a spouse selects a spouse, is there a range of suitors? And
Match.com.
And when you say carefully, if you could just talk about how you know, when you go to Kenya and you've got the Quakers, okay, that's kind of a no-brainer, kind of. But how do you... How does AFSC know a partner when it has met one?
Right. You know, one thing about the work is because it is there for a long time, you know, our partners change. You know, they don't stay the same, you know. But because we are in a country for a long time, we participate in a lot of different exchanges, dialogues, activities. We initiate some of those. And we do some scouting, you know, because we invite people to these exchanges. Next month, we're hosting a global dialogue and exchange on global peacemaking in Thailand. And so we're inviting all sorts of experts in peace building from the global south, also experts from the north, to talk about sort of what's new in peace building and what are the approaches and what are the trends to help inform our strategic planning process. Well, in that meeting, we will spot some wonderful organization that we have not worked with before. You know, we've been with them in a dialogue, in a discussion before, and then if we are initiating new work, then we have them in mind because we know their track record, we know what they've presented. So there is that relationship that wasn't based on a funding agreement or anything like that, but at least we have known them in that capacity. And I think the local knowledge, one thing I'm very proud of, in Africa, for example, 100% of our staff, country directors included, are all from Africa. Are Africans. So the local knowledge, so we don't have, you know, an American going to lead and head the program in Zimbabwe, and they know nothing, and then they start picking and choosing partners. You know, the local knowledge is with our staff who have lived in that country for a long time. They understand our values and our need to find partners that are like-minded, that speak our language, meaning they speak the language of nonviolence and tolerance and peace. And so they're able to discern that and provide us. The back as well.
You mentioned capacity building in your talk, and I know because I used to work for an international organization, so it's kind of a buzzword, and instead of doing technical assistance, you know, telling people the right way of doing X, you're supposed to be building their capacity to figure out how to do X. Of course, as you pointed out, it's kind of not real capacity building because For one thing, the real capacity building takes a long time. So, you know, the long-term presence, maybe, I guess my question is, to what extent do you see AFSC is doing capacity building, and you know, how is it different from this sort of fake capacity building, if you like, or and you know, is there a critique of it, and do you frame it in that way, and also, is there like an exit strategy so that, you know, once people can do things on their own, then you can just let them get on with it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that the capacity building does take time. And what I've seen is that AFSC has successfully devolved a lot of great programs that they started and supported the local community. And then the local community said, okay, we want to do this on our own. And then did an exit of like, you know, 2 or 3 years for the devolvement to take place. One example that's happening as we speak is our program in Baltimore. We are so proud of it, the Friend of a Friend program in Baltimore. It is an amazing program. It works with the incarcerated. And but then the heads of the program came to us and said, we want to devolve. We want to be on our own. We was sad, you know, sad to accept them going because they do an incredible work, but this is what you want. Okay, let's support you in doing that. How do we do it responsibly, you know? So we said, okay, we're going to give you funding for 3 years and, you know, and then exit slowly to ensure, and we're going to help you with relationship building and fundraising and all of that to ensure that you're able to do it on your own. So we do have sort of a devolvement strategy that we use in the event that we have a program that decides, you know, they want to be on their own. Our programs in general don't have a life cycle, and I've discovered that a lot of programs in AFSC sort of are there for good. And that's something that we're trying to build in within the new strategic plan is, you know, let's do a 10-year life cycle and let's see if we could sort of manage to evaluate the programs and what difference they are making in a 10-year cycle to see when is it time to devolve. You know, it may be that they need another 10 years. Maybe they want to devolve earlier, you know, so we are still in discussion on that life cycle of a program because what I've discovered is programs last. But that's why we're so rooted in communities because our programs have been there forever. Yeah. So capacity building is, you know, it's the one thing about the difference between our work, and I'm sure you already know this, our work internationally and our work in the U.S., is in the U.S., our staff do the work. They are the activists. You know, they are the ones who go on the front line. They are the ones who design the brochures and go and demonstrate. They are the ones who challenge, you know, their state legislatures. So they are our staff. We're very operational in the U.S. Internationally, we go through partners. So it's a different type of dynamic. But I am, you know, I definitely don't believe in the technical assistance and training that, you know, millions if not billions of dollars have been spent on these trainings and technical assistance that, you know, their benefits just disappear just because, as I mentioned earlier, they're very short term, hit and run, do it, leave. And I think our approach is really proving to be beneficial because we've seen so many examples of people and programs just shining on their own after they're finished with our work. There's a question in the back here. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. And a member of our Southeast Executive Committee.
I'm off now.
Oh, you're off.
I've been there for a long time.
I've been there for a long time.
Joyce, this is not directly related to AFSC program, but I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you, as AFSC, are relating to the new Poor People's Campaign.
Oh, great. Yes. Well, I was talk about provocative and courageous work. I received an email from staff a few months ago saying, Joyce would really, really want to participate in the Poor People's Campaign, and this is what it entails. So it was a moral revival, and it was a campaign for that to reignite the MLK campaign. So when I read it, and they said, we want support of as staff of AFSC because we're doing civil disobedience. This is a civil disobedience action for 40 days of civil disobedience, and we want you to have our backs. So obviously we have a civil disobedience policy. And as soon as I read this, I'm like, yes, of course. And so I sent it to the board, and you won't believe how supportive the board was. And so we quickly turned this around, and we said to staff, and to governance members that, we support their civil disobedience, and we're in with them on this. And so with the 40 days of civil disobedience in action, several of our staff were actually arrested, and so that was really cool. And so we thought, that's what we're about. We're about, doing the courageous, standing by justice, standing by our allies, and supporting these efforts. So.
Joyce, I wanted to return to what you talked about with fear that exists among the many people in Israel, and addressing that, because that's a sort of a personal problem for me. I have a good friend, and we're in sync on everything except this issue. She is Jewish, multi-generations. Her ancestors fled various pogroms, and what she says to me that made the most sense, but I don't know how to approach it, maybe you do, that in the back of her mind, she always has a bag packed and is ready to flee. And this is the kind of fear. I can't talk to her about anything around Palestine because it's like talking to somebody who's secluded in an underground bunker because of this fear. Have you had any success, inklings at all, in addressing this part of the problem?
Her fear comes from Palestinians or from the Arab world, or where does her fear come from? Or is it anti-Semitism? What is it that is causing?
It comes from always having felt persecuted down through the generations.
Okay.
It's almost in her DNA and genetic.
Yeah. And that's one thing that after I studied about the history of the Jewish people, like my son, I've come to realize that this sense of fear and for personal security is real. The thing is, for how to resolve it, it's difficult, because also the government of Israel, in my opinion, plays on that fear a lot and uses it. And uses it in ways that, in my opinion, are not logical. When I speak to my Israeli friends who live in Israel now, the young ones, the ones that, they don't really, they're in a different world. And this is one thing my son told me, because he went to Jerusalem, right, to go to Yad Vashem. And he's like, Mom, it's a different world. They're in a different world. They don't have a worry in their life. They are just so, free to do what they want, clueless about what we're going through. Palestinians feel that the persecution of the Jewish people sort of laid on their shoulders, and they took the brunt of it when they had no responsibility for it. And so this is where it's like, as a Palestinian, don't look at me and ask me to solve your fear, I had nothing to do with it, And so it's difficult. It's a difficult question. It's very ingrained. It's very ingrained. How do you provide security for a people who fear, the Holocaust may happen again, and they want to make sure that they are surrounded by walls and by, everything that protects them to ensure that this will never happen to them again, even if they subjugate another people and take away their freedom and it's us, And how do I help them break away from that? It's so difficult. I don't have the answer. Yes.
Well, there is actually an answer, but it's not very easy, which is to accept that you're saying, how do you provide security? Well, the answer is there is no security. But that's tremendously liberating. If we can get there, then you provide a wonderful service to all those people who are liberated from fear.
But it's
not easy to do, of course.
Yeah. Right. Are we almost done?
One more. I went to the 100-year anniversary, and I was learned that AFSC was in North Korea, and I was somewhat shocked.
Yeah.
But I was just curious if AFSC is also in Iran.
No.
No.
No, we're not in Iran.
Okay.
I think we were some years ago, decades ago, at one point, but nothing recent.
Thank you so much, Joyce.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm sure I speak for some of us, if not all of us, that we will hold you and AFSC in the light in that great work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bless you.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you, friends.
Bless you all.
You're at liberty.